for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. For the first time since 2005, people outside the U.S. see America's influence in the world as more positive than negative. But here at home, President Obama's job approval rating is about 48%, compared with 70% when he took office 15 months ago. Joining me to talk about President Obama's evolving leadership style and effectiveness, James Thurber. He's professor and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Richard Murphy, who served as U.S. ambassador to Syria, the Philippines, and Saudi Arabia, and Ron Elving. He's Washington editor for NPR. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We've already received several messages from Facebook. You can also send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ambassador Murphy, if I could start with you. Polls indicate that abroad, President Obama is enjoying something of an upswing in popularity. How people feel about him across and around the world. What do we know about how he's perceived and why?
Well, Diane, I was traveling last month in the Middle East, in the Gulf, in Syria, Beirut in particular, and what I was hearing was how surprised they were that he had fallen so far and so fast in popularity at home. That said, he had dropped somewhat in popularity since his election. They had very high expectations that with him to office came a magic wand, and with his personal wielding of that, there was going to be some pretty vast changes in problems that have lingered on and festered for the last half century and more. Now, I think that they have been impressed by his rhetoric since the election, the high point being the Cairo speech of last summer, when he was trying to explain America's desire for improved relations with the Muslim world, and then watching his domestic successes, which most notably, of course, in the health reform. And they track us very closely. They read our journals, they listen to our radios and watch the television, and they're very sensitive to the ebb and flow of presidential power. But I think that they do feel renewed hope that there's been a change in America and a president who is ready to engage personally in their issues.
During the campaign, there were accusations even from now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that then Senator Obama did not have sufficient foreign policy credentials, that he didn't have the experience to deal with the multiple problems awaiting him. To what extent do you believe his critics were right? To what extent has his style changed?
Well, they were right that he didn't have the experience, that he didn't have the on-the-job training in Washington politics and policy making. They were wrong in labeling him naive. And I haven't heard that word naive used in recent months as he's dealt with issues from the global ones of nuclear nonproliferation to some of the issues involving economic developments in India, in China, his identification with those issues has given him some new standing and new respect overseas.
Richard Murphy, he served as U.S. ambassador to Syria, the Philippines, and Saudi Arabia. He's former assistant secretary of state for Near East and South Asian affairs under President Reagan. Turning to you now, Jim Thurber, President Obama inherited so many problems, particularly on the economic front. He also had an ambitious agenda of his own. How would you assess his effectiveness so far?
Well, let's remember his accomplishments so far. He pushed through just recently a historic health care reform bill. But before that, people forget, at the very beginning, within the first 100 days, he signed the Lilly Ledbetter Act that had been vetoed before. He had...
Which did what? Remind us.
Sorry. It was an act to bring women's wages up to the level of men's wages for the same performance. He also signed an executive order. It's very important in town, reforming ethics and lobbying. He's been attacking lobbyists to the criticism of some. He signed an expansion of S-CHIP, which is children's health insurance, which was also vetoed. He signed the stimulus package, $787 billion. Much of it, by the way, were tax cuts. A lot of people don't realize this. Unemployment compensation and Medicaid, that's insurance for the poor. He also signed an executive order calling for the closure of Guantanamo detention camp. It's becoming very difficult. He centralized power in the White House with the czars. We don't hear much about that. He pushed EPA to begin to implement the so-called cap-and-trade provisions. In other words, climate change provisions, because Congress seemed to be stymied on that. He pushed for climate change by allowing the chairs on the Hill really to have too much power, and I think he learned a lesson from that, and in healthcare. He's got competition with the chairs, the leadership, individuals on the Hill, and he's learned on the job how to really focus that and push it through. And I think the health care bill is an example of it.
James Thurber, he's professor and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. So, Ron Elving, you've just heard a list of many accomplishments, and yet, is it because of those very accomplishments that the president's popularity is sinking in this country?
I would not say that it was because of those accomplishments that his popularity was shrinking. In fact, I would hazard the guess that the biggest problem with his popularity is the persistence of problems that he inherited and that he has not made enough progress in the eyes of the public at diminishing. Most importantly, the health of the economy and the creation of jobs. The jobless rate still being too close to 10%, I think, dominates the popular imagination. And even those people who are aware that the stock market is making a rather remarkable comeback and that the consensus of economists is that we've turned it around, even those people do not feel better, particularly not if they're personally touched by unemployment, if they have lost a job themselves, if they have people close to them who have, and many of us are in exactly that position. So I think the dominant thing that is weighing down on Barack Obama is that some problems have persisted. And as Ambassador Murphy said, expectations were very high. People were expecting a magic wand. And we are still in Afghanistan. We are still in Iraq. The problems with Pakistan don't seem to be getting any better. The Iran question is as great as ever. Gitmo is not closed yet. And despite all the high-mindedness, both on foreign and domestic policy, most people feel the persistence of problems much more keenly. Now, of course, there are also people who are pushing back very much against what they perceive as overreach by the federal government and constitutional violations. You can hear all manner of talk about the terrible things about what the Obama administration is doing. But while that has dominated a lot of the attention of the last year, I would say the preponderance of the suffering that Barack Obama has done in terms of the descent of his polls from the 60s to the high 40s has been because of the persistence of problems he has not been able to solve that he largely inherited.
Ron Helbing, he's Washington editor for NPR. Do join us by phone, by email. Send us a tweet. Join us on Facebook. Ron, the president is making a personal appeal for financial reform directly to Wall Street tomorrow. To what extent does that appeal reflect his strategy on health care?
I think the strategy on financial re-regulation has a tremendous benefit from the experience of healthcare, but it's also a fundamentally different issue. Here you have automatically the easy populist appeal of saying, let's take a look at the one institution in the country that people distrust more than Congress, and or at least equally with Congress, and that is the banking in Wall Street image, the banking in Wall Street cartoon, if you will. It's not so much the small banks or the banks that people personally deal with. It's the image of the financial community. So here, as opposed to going after, quotation marks here, the healthcare system, which was never really exactly what they were trying to reform. It was more about healthcare insurance. But the idea that healthcare, which most people think in their own case isn't too bad, and most people feel they're getting good healthcare, for most people, this did not feel like something that helped them personally or that satisfied their urge for revenge against somebody. The financial industry, totally different picture. So when the president goes up to Cooper Union tomorrow and he says, you guys are going to have to straighten out your act. I got the SEC behind me. We're coming after some of you people and we're going to re-regulate you. The American people are with him.
Ron Helbing, Washington editor for NPR. When we come back, we'll talk more about both foreign and domestic issues, how the president is doing, his poll numbers. Stay with us. Welcome back. With me in the studio, Richard Murphy. He served as U.S. ambassador to Syria, the Philippines, and Saudi Arabia. Ron Helbing, Washington editor for NPR. And James Thurber. He's professor and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. We're, pardon me. Talking about the president's leadership style, how it's changed, how it's evolved. The poll numbers reflected not only here, but abroad. Here's a message from Sean on Facebook, who says, I like President Obama's intellectual and pragmatic blend, but I don't think many Americans like to think of their president as viewing the world this way. Pardon me. They like black and white leadership styles when the world needs leaders that see things in shades of gray. Ambassador Murphy.
Well, I think Sean's view of the president is very accurate. He is comfortable with complex issues, and he sees grays far more often than he appears to see black and white in problems. Okay. Let's take one example from the recent past. It was very easy for the leadership of Iran, comparatively easy, to deal with President Bush. They caricatured him as a quick-on-the-draw cowboy, and they had him typecast. And there were those in the radical extremist Muslim groups who were easily able to portray him as an enemy of Islam, an enemy of progress and development in the Islamic world. They can't do that with President Obama. He makes a very difficult target for them. They are off balance. Now, does that mean he's going to have a signal breakthrough with Iran? Maybe not. But they don't know how to handle him yet. They haven't found the key.
Here is another message from Facebook. Kate writes, does anyone on the panel know what George Bush did his first year in office? Would be interesting to compare Obama's first year. As I recall, President Bush took lots of vacation and did not initiate any programs or policies, and there was little complaining from the public. Here's the question. Do Americans prefer a less ambitious president, James Thurber?
Well, President Bush had major tax cuts, which are always popular, of course, at the very beginning of his presidency. He had a negotiated relationship with Senator Kennedy in passing No Child Left Behind, which became very unpopular. He sort of alienated some of his party so much that Jeffords left the party after 7 months, became an independent, and the Democrats took over the Senate chairs, which means that it stopped his agenda in its tracks. And then on 9/11, of course, the first year of his administration, everything changed. And we had rally effects, and he went up to over 90% in the polls from about 50% in 1 week. And from then on out, his presidency changed. It was focused on homeland security, reorganization eventually, and spending lots of money on homeland security. So it was really a presidency for 7 months and then a different presidency for the rest of his time.
So really very difficult to compare the first year of both, Ron.
Yes, indeed. Tremendously difficult. You know, this concept, too, that that government is best that governs least, a very popular idea among Americans and certainly voiced many times in politics, even by those who govern the most. I think what people really like is, or maybe we could put it this other way, that government is most blessed that needs to govern the least. Government in good times can be very popular because it doesn't need to do very much except stay out of the way, and people are happy because the times are good. Therefore, they think well of their administration. On the other hand, if someone comes to office and does very little in the midst of the worst recession since the 1930s, that's not going to be popular with anyone.
Here is a quote from David Broder's column last week. He called President Obama the patient president. Ambassador Murphy, how does that patience come into his approach on the Arab-Israeli problem, and how does that compare perhaps to his predecessors?
He's been the first president to ever articulate the view that the Arab-Israeli confrontation involved vital American national interests. Others, his predecessors, have consistently spoken of our efforts to bring peace to the Middle East for the good of Israel, for the security of Israel, for the good of the Palestinians. There has to be a peace agreement. Now, this has continued with President Obama's to be his position, but he has added this concern that it affects us directly. And I think that that signals a readiness to be identified as an activist president in the Middle East dispute. I don't think he's a man that has illusions about it, although he did, in my opinion, misstep last fall or last year when he singled out the issue of the need for a freeze of Israeli settlements to balance some concessions from the Arab side, balanced by concessions. I think that he put a spotlight on an issue which has been frozen for many years in Israeli politics. But he has said he will continue engaged, that he will be engaged, he will persist. And his very appointment of a persistent envoy, namely George Mitchell, is the signal of that. From day one of the administration, there the president was with Mitchell at his side at the State Department saying we're going to work on this, and he gave it great priority. The first step may have been a misstep, but it is continuing, and he is obviously looking for ways to convince both sides that there's something better can result from negotiations than they have today.
And yet, in the most recent issue of Foreign Policy magazine, Aaron David Miller has a piece he calls The False Religion of Mideast Peace. I wonder whether he is suggesting that perhaps America's commitment to Arab-Israeli peacemaking, maybe we should step back. Jim Thurber.
Well, I think that the ambassador knows this better than the rest of us. He's been at tables over the years negotiating on this particular issue. I would say that I would add to Broder's statement that he really is a president that listens and he studies, and he took months to study whether he should redeploy troops, and he's doing that, I think, with Israel and Palestine, with respect to nonproliferation, with respect to Iran, and I think that's good. He is non-ideological, he's pragmatic, and he's culturally sensitive to other countries. And let's point out here also, he's made more trips overseas than any other president at this point in his presidency, and I think that is good. And he's made very few mistakes when he's gone overseas. And I think he's humble. He's ambitious, but he's humble, and I think people appreciate that. And yet, when it comes to Israel and Palestine, the ambassador knows better than the rest of us, it's almost an intractable situation for any president in a short period of time of 18 months.
Ambassador Murphy.
I think Aaron Miller's made a very good point. However, he is not saying we should not be working on the problems. He's just saying don't have any illusions that you're going to have the great breakthrough because neither party is ready for it. But I don't think that Aaron would deny that the passage of time has made the issues harder and harder year after year. And I think that is a caution that the White House has taken aboard and recognizes that maybe it'll be incremental steps, small steps, but there are steps that can be taken, compromises that can be worked out.
And back to jobs. As you talked about earlier, Ron Elving, as you've said, the American public doesn't see how directly it has been affected by healthcare legislation. Do you believe that if the administration is successful in coming through with financial reform, that might influence people's thinking about how this administration and this president is doing?
It might well, and probably should. If the process on financial re-regulation unfolds the way it appears to be unfolding this week, with some bringing in of Republican input, I am guessing here, for example, that the $50 billion resolution fund that can be portrayed by Republicans as taxpayer-paid, even if the taxpayers in this case are banks, that's an argument that could probably be resolved by just removing the fund. And I think the administration is signaling that could happen. If that does happen, and if they can work out the language with respect to derivatives, many other things that are at work here, if that gets done, it's going to have a patina of bipartisanship that was almost utterly lacking in healthcare. The big problem with healthcare was they wanted to be bipartisan, so they started with a bill that largely came from Republican minds back in the 1990s. All those fellows, unfortunately, are gone. John Chafee, Bob Dole, David Durenberger. So you were using Republicans from the wrong decade. Their ideas were largely incorporated into the bill, the base of the bill, but they were not embraced by the current Republicans who decided to oppose it and make a political point of doing so. Financial reg looks different.
Jim Thurber, you've said that the president overlearned Bill Clinton's efforts at health care.
Well, in 1993 and 94, the Clintons had a health care bill, and they really didn't adequately reach out and work with the barons, the chairs on the Hill, the Rostenkowskis and others. And Rahm Emanuel learned that, and he encouraged the president, in my opinion, to reach out, let the chairs have a certain amount of leeway. And I think that was a mistake on the stimulus package. By the way, he came up with a number, and they really put it together. He didn't have a lot of input. Secondly, on cap and trade, he forced Waxman and Markey passed a bill that was very liberal compared to the Senate, but also compared to what the Blue Dogs wanted. They voted for it. Blue Dogs are fiscal conservative Democrats in the House. It was very hard for many of them to vote for it. Then when it came to health care, they allowed a great deal of freedom also to Waxman and Dingell and others in the House, and they passed quite a liberal bill compared to the Senate. In the end, they took the Senate bill, and as you know, they used this arcane, not so arcane, but this reconciliation process to correct the Senate bill, which was very different than the Waxman bill. Yeah. He finally jumped in. Now, Eisenhower was similar in the sense that he had the, quote, hidden hand. He stayed back. He didn't engage. And if you read works about Eisenhower, which I've been doing lately, I have a book on Eisenhower and Congress going, he regretted that, especially with McCarthy and other foreign policy issues. He should have engaged. I think that Obama has realized he must engage with these people early, and he's doing that with financial reform.
Jim Thurber of the American University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. There's a question I want to ask all of you, and that is, to what extent has the rhetoric that is rampant around this country, how is that affecting how people think about this president and this administration? Ron Elving.
It's had an enormous effect, I think, and this has been an era of hyper-communication. We all spend far more of our day communicating and taking in information from many, many different sources than I think we did 30, 40 years ago. On the other hand, when people suggest that this is unprecedented, that the terrible things that are said about this president or about the last president, George W. Bush, who was also very much abused in the public airwaves and in the public prints, that this has somehow turned some sort of corner and we've gone into another era, I'm reminded by the things that are said about presidents further back in our past. I just saw a quotation from Alf Landon in 1936 saying that if FDR were elected, he was going to put an end to elections and the right to peaceably assemble and the right to own property and so forth. Really quite extreme accusations being thrown at FDR by the Republican nominee of 1936. I don't think in the end there's anything really new about the rough talk and the tough talk. I do think it is much more omnipresent in our lives, and that's the difference.
Jim Thurber.
I think we should look at the T groups and public opinion differently from governing. Basically, the president needs 60 votes to get what he wants, and he doesn't have 60 votes. And if the party opposing him, the Republican Party, has very few moderates, I mean, that's the endangered species in Washington, not the polar bear, in moderate Republicans. If he doesn't have moderate Republicans and there's nobody in the middle to go to, he has problems governing. Now, the outside is important. The outside will affect the 2010 election. And in fact, it may hurt the Republican Party if they go too far to the right and recruit people that do not reflect the Republican Party sort of in the middle in these competitive districts. So, yes, that's very interesting to see the T groups and alarming sometimes. But in the end, I think he's focused on governing, getting those votes, and I think he's going to get it with financial reform.
Ambassador Murphy.
I think overseas, presidential rhetoric has been a big change. He has been able to communicate to people in troubled areas. I care about your problems. I'm not sure what can be done, but I am concerned about them. And this is a big part of his popularity. Not that he necessarily is going to produce the result I, the citizen of X, want to see, but he cares, he's following, and sooner or later he's going to see the justice and the truth of my position. And this has gotten them excited. They remain excited about the potential of American leadership. He has brought that image back through the Non-Proliferation Conference and many other issues.
However, the people that he's talking to overseas have to change their behavior in some cases. They like him a lot. The leaders like him, but they are not going along with what we want frequently. The Non-Proliferation Agreement is very important. It's a real threat to the world. But let's watch behavior. Let's see what the rest of the nations do. Let's see how many people stay in Afghanistan when we're there.
James Thurper of the American University. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. We'll take your calls, read your email, and your other messages. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
20 years ago, NASA launched the Hubble Space Telescope. The lead astrophysicist on its history, how the telescope forever changed our view of the universe, and why he believes there's life beyond Earth. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's our first email as we talk about the president, the job he's done, what he's accomplished, and the kinds of roadblocks he's run into. This is from Jerry in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He says, I believe Obama's whole problem is that people elected him and a Democratic Congress to get things done. But instead of trying to get things done, they've cowered in the corner when the minority has threatened filibuster. Jim.
Well, it's not only the Senate. The House Democrats are made up of three groups, the progressives on the left, sort of the middle Democrats, and the Blue Dog Democrats that don't agree with a lot of these provisions that the president wanted to push through. And yes, we have the problem of the filibuster, and after the special election of Brown from Massachusetts, the Democrats no longer have 60 votes. They barely had 60 votes anyway because of diversity and individualism in the Senate. So I don't think they're cowering. I don't think he's compromising too much. It's phenomenal, actually, how much political capital he's used and how many times he's gone out of town to try to explain to people what the problems are, what the solutions are. I think they've done phenomenally well with only 59 votes.
All right. To Rochester, New York. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I just want to explain an experience I had, and maybe this is telling. I woke up on the morning of the Cairo speech, remembering that he was going to give the speech that night. And I went on to the internet to see if I could find out what he had said. And there was a link or whatever, and he was in the process of still giving the speech. And I went over to that link, and it was set up sort of like C-SPAN. There were no commentators. And I was watching it, and as I watched it or whatever, towards the end of the speech or whatever, I was just blown away. I had hairs on the back of my neck standing up, and I had tears in my eyes, and I thought, my gosh, what a difference this is. And how can anybody say anything about this? And I turned on the network TV, and Diane Sawyer, who I admire also very much, was on, and she was interviewing none other than Sean Hannity at the time, and they were talking about the speech that was just given by President Obama. Now, when I was on the internet at the end of the speech, the camera just stood still, and it showed the crowd of students standing up, and they too, you could tell, were very moved by what was said, and very sort of shaking their heads, and like they were all like laughing and smiling and stuff, and when I cut over back to the network or whatever, it was like a different world.
Interesting. Ambassador Murphy, do you want to comment?
I don't know what would make Sean Hannity stand up and applaud. Anything to do with, I think, with the Democrats, he's got an image that they can do no good and that his mission in life is to criticize everything, every action that's taken.
Here's an email on that very point. It's from William in Dallas. He says, I think your discussants are missing the elephant in the room, the fact that the president and liberals in general are the targets of vicious daily abuse by conservative pundits, talk show hosts, and a host of Republican operatives. Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and the whole grassroots teabag party movement pour invective and obvious falsehoods onto the airwaves that is cheerfully reported by a compliant and lazy media. That's the first time I've heard that Diane Sawyer interviewed Sean Hannity. After that speech, it sort of takes my breath away.
Curious choice. Not clear what she was trying to get from that particular interview at that particular moment. Certainly not a foreign policy expert. But let's look at the media, generally speaking. I think 2006 was a year in which the media generally ignored Barack Obama or doubted him. In 2007, they were discovering him. In 2008, they were falling for the phenomenon of Barack Obama, and maybe falling for is too negative a term. They were blown away by the phenomenon of Barack Obama, who was coming from way back in the pack and coming from relative obscurity to become the front runner for president in a matter of weeks. And the media, in a very real sense, fell in love with him. Then 2009 became the year of, oh, here we have this president, and we are widely perceived as having fallen in love with him, and we are widely perceived as being in his corner and being his advocates, and we have to step back and take a much more assessing view of this president. And so that was the dominant 2009 theme in the American media. Now, I'm not talking here about the dedicated conservative media. I'm not talking about that group of people because they were obviously on a different trajectory throughout. But among those people in what is generally referred to as the mainstream media, I think those were generally speaking the phases of the relationship. 2010 is shaping up to be something a little bit different. Healthcare surprised a lot of people by getting passed. The financial reg bill could be another bit of a surprise. The nuclear agreement with the Russians, the nuclear anti-proliferation agreement. A number of things have made the president look more presidential than he did at any point in 2009. So I think that there could be another sea change underway.
Ambassador Murphy.
And actually, when you look at two of the major involvements we're in the Middle East area, for instance, Iraq and Afghanistan, the media, for whatever it said, put that aside. The fact is he's had Republican support in the Congress. He has continued. Part of the reason is he continued the Bush policy of withdrawing, drawing down in Iraq. So Republicans approve that. He's shown he is ready to use the weapons of war in Afghanistan, that he's not a wimp. And this has, again, dulled the edge of some of the criticisms that were leveled at him before he was elected.
All right. To Miami, Florida. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, panel. I just wanted to make the quick statement that I think a lot of the President Obama's agenda has been hindered by the rhetoric and the actions taken by some other conservatives and other individuals. I mean, the fact that people are bringing guns into political rallies is something that makes me, as an American, very sad. And as Americans, you know, we are driven by immediate results, and patience is not one of our best qualities. But I think the president has realized that he needs to speak to the citizens and let them know what his agenda is and how he's fighting for us and working for the betterment of America. He's also realized that he needs to be involved and not leave it all to Congress to take care of it. Personally, you know, I'm very proud of having President Obama as my president because he uses reason as reason to make his decisions. And as such, you know, I used to be an independent before, but now I'm a Democrat.
Karen, thanks for calling. Jim Thurber, she suggests the president needs to get out there more to make sure people hear his message. Has that been part of the problem?
It's been part of his strategy. He's been out of town a great deal of the time trying to describe what the problems are, say, in healthcare and financial reform, and what the solutions are that he's pushing. But they're so complex, and it's so easy to reframe from the Republicans about death panels and a variety of other things. Death panels out of a 2,000-page bill, it's a paragraph, and it changes the whole debate. It creates a lot of anger. And the media, Ron, likes to cover things that are new and bad. You know, they don't cover the fact that the ambassador pointed out that the Republicans really are helping him on defense policy, a lot of foreign policy, on education policy also. They like Arne Duncan. So that's not newsworthy. Yes, it gets in, but page 17 of some newspaper. And so that's a problem. And also the media can't figure out what they're doing these days. Is it entertainment or is it information? I mean, when you bring a extreme conservative on right after a speech that knows very little about foreign policy, that's entertainment. And it's ridiculous, Ron.
Yes, I believe it is ridiculous. And while I don't particularly feel responsible for everything that appears or that is heard in the media, I think that a lot of the criticism that you level is quite legitimate. We do prefer things that are new, and we do prefer things that are conflictual, and we do prefer to bring on critics after we have put on the president. So we will always be subject to all of those criticisms.
Well, I will continue to try on this program to bring ideas that are worthy of hearing to the people of the world, because there are knowledgeable folks here in this studio, and we continue to try to bring such people onto the air. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Basically, my thought is that President Obama, he is a centrist president. You know, I think a lot of times when we talk about the polls, we don't talk about the dissatisfaction of progressives who voted for him, who feel that he hasn't went far enough on issues such as health care, even on this financial reform, that he hasn't pushed for tougher reform. And, I, you know, but I think that the president is, you know, okay with where he's at.
You know, it's interesting. We have a message posted on our website from Barb, who says, precisely as Kevin does, I think the falling approval rate of the president may be proof he is doing exactly what he should be. The extreme right thinks he's doing too much. Progressives think he's doing too little. President can't do everything at once, so progressives are unhappy. Reactionary right's unhappy that he's doing too much. I personally am impressed with how much he has done in the face of massive Republican resistance. Would you agree with that, Ambassador Murphy?
I see a man who is very confident in himself. I see a man who last fall, was being criticized by progressives and by the conservatives for inaction on Afghanistan. A prolonged review. He kept telling his experts, go back, give me some more ideas, give me some other ways we might approach this. He was not afraid of looking indecisive. He's a man who speaks confidently about our strength and is not worried by much of any criticism that seems to be thrown at him. It doesn't stick to him.
I would call him the professor president, and I know that in the press that's a negative thing, but he likes to listen. He did when he was in the Senate. He does now, and as the ambassador pointed out, he took his time. This is a very serious thing, what we're doing in Afghanistan,
but,
and he takes his time with a whole lot of things.
But,
I like that.
I wonder if you think he hasn't adjusted his approach over this 15 months, Ron.
I think he's been constantly adjusting his approach, and I don't think that it's a simple linear adjustment. I don't think he has gone from being one kind of president to being another kind entirely. He has used different methods depending on what might work. I think he's highly adaptive. I think he believes in pragmatics.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Haverhill, Massachusetts. Good morning, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you. There's one area that I'm very disappointed in Barack Obama is on the civil liberties issues. For instance, warrantless wiretapping is still going on. He's not going to the FISA court ahead before he does that. Also, some certain prisoners in Guantanamo, there's not going to be any trials for them. There's going to be indefinite to stay in prison. Also, over in Afghanistan, in the Bagram Air Force base there, we have 600 prisoners, and they're denied habeas corpus. And a lot of those prisoners were fingered by other people who were playing bounty for. Also, Diane, I think as time goes on, it should at least have a truth commission on how we got into the war in Iraq. And Barack said we should look forward and not backward, and at least have a Watergate committee or some commission. Because as time goes on, we will never know the full truth of why we got into the war.
All right. Jim Thurber.
I would add to the list that the left is very upset about the war in Afghanistan generally, but also the use of Predator aircraft to kill people in Pakistan and Afghanistan. But also, for the first time, I think, in the history, recent history of the United States, the president has agreed to assassinate a U.S. citizen who happens to be in Yemen, who is a mullah there that's been connected to some of these terrorist activities. The left is quiet, but they're upset. I just had Daniel Ellsberg at American University on a panel, and he said exactly the same thing as this person. And Daniel Ellsberg, as you know, was the person who revealed the Pentagon Papers and took a conscience over career, and he thinks that he's upset with Obama as this individual, as Richard
does. Does Daniel Ellsberg agree with Richard that there should be a commission to investigate how we got into the war in the first place?
Yes, and a commission or more activity looking into torture and doing something about that who did the torture.
Ambassador Murphy.
I would welcome such a commission as we did on 9/11. It's got to be a bipartisan, fully serious group of citizenry involved, and we can only benefit by that kind of checking back.
And yet the president keeps saying, I want to look forward, I don't want to look back.
Which is possibly a principled decision on his part, and it is also part of that pragmatic viewpoint that I mentioned earlier. He did not want health care or climate change or the financial re-regulation bill to be in some way or another inhibited by the going forward of such a commission, and he saw it as politically divisive, and he saw it as something that would put him at war with Congress. Now, he has had that war with Congress to a large degree anyway, but he was hoping a year ago, when he more or less made this call, that by having peace on that front, he might purchase peace elsewhere.
So now,
I'm not saying when exactly, but I could imagine a time when the political climate is better for just such a commission.
Quickly, Jim.
Yes, and as Rahm Emanuel said, he doesn't want a flock of geese to get in the way of this Guantanamo.
Jim Thurber of the American University, Ambassador Richard Murphy, and Ron Elving, Washington editor for NPR. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.